great to have you here today, Tony. You've got an interesting story. Well, it started off with an email, I believe, that came out of the blue, promising money, and all sorts of alarm bells went off about what that might have meant.
Yeah, I had an email at the beginning of October, which had all the hallmarks of being a scam. It came from a firm of lawyers in the north of England, or at least it purported to come from them, and it told me that Richard Alsop had died, and he wished to leave 2,500 English pounds to any children that I had who were alive when he died. Well, I have four, and so that's 10,000 pounds. Well, I worried about this, so I have a friend who's a lawyer in York. I mean, can you believe a lawyer with a friend? But anyway, and I sent it off to him and said, what do you think? And he wrote back immediately and said, well, look, I think it's a scam. However, he did a bit of research. He said this law firm does exist, and this fellow Richard Alsop did die, and he was the professor of transport engineering at London University. Well, that sort of rang bells because I'd done things in transport. Anyway, the golden rule with an email like that is you don't answer it. What I did is looked up the law firm, and I wrote to the partner, the chief of the law firm, not the person who sent me the email, mm-hmm. and expressed my concerns about this. And I got an email back the following day, not from her, but from a man who had succeeded Richard Alsop in the chair of transport engineering in London, a man called Ben Haydecker, didn't know him either, saying that, oh yes, Richard had done a lot of work with the Department of Transport, and he was very proud of the fact that during his involvement, the traffic toll in England had decreased considerably. But he realised that he wasn't the only person making a contribution there, and what he wanted to do in his will was to leave money to the families of all those people who'd made a substantial contribution to road safety during his period. Well, I didn't know I had. I was astonished by this. My first feeling was that this was to do with the parking sensor. You will recall that I invented the parking sensor. It was a spin-off, my aid for the blind. But, you know, the Department of Transport knew nothing about this, and I'm sure he would know nothing about it. And then I recalled various things I had done with the department, and there were basically three things. Mm-hmm. I served on a committee called the Joint Mobility Committee. It met in London. It was joint because it was the agencies for the blind joined together. So there were representatives from the agencies. There were three or four blind people. There were a couple of academics, of which I was one, and about three people from the Department of Transport. What happened in this committee is essentially the blind people asked for the world, and the Department of Transport people said, you can't have that. And I was a bit of a piggy in the middle because I had partially sighted, and I was interested in the needs of the blind, but I had a technical background. Mm-hmm. And there was one very, very famous occasion, I remember it well. The Department of Transport had decided to lower the curbs at crossings to help wheelchair people so that they could use the crossings without having to do a sort of wheelie up the curve and things like that. And the blind people were incensed. No, they were going to write to their members of parliament. They were going to...
Oh, because they could feel it with their cane. They could feel the drop-off.
Well, with their cane or with their feet, they needed to square off to these curbs. They needed the curbs. And the people from the Department of Transport were horrified at the prospect of two disabled groups fighting over a decision that they had made. And I simply made the simple suggestion, and this is not rocket science. And we're talking about 50 years ago. This is the 1970s.
Yeah, that's right.
A long time ago. I said, how about we design a textured surface that could go across the front of the crossing that wouldn't impede the wheelchairs and yet had enough texture to enable blind people to feel it and square up on it.
And they're used in Australia, aren't they? Those sort of white panels with the little knobbly...
Absolutely. They're tiles. All over the world. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So that's your idea.
Yeah, but this is the 70s. And I said, look, if you're going to do that, why don't you put a strip of the texture across the footpath? You call them footpaths, we call them pavements in England, and of course the Americans call them sidewalks.
Yeah.
Put a strip across the sidewalk or the footpath,
yeah,
and so the blind people can find the crossing.
Mm.
Well, this was a win-win situation, and everybody went away very happy. Well, about 9 months later, I was invited to Crowthorne, where they have the Road Research Laboratory. Crowthorne's almost famous. Also famous because it's Her Majesty's prison for the criminally insane, but they don't share the same building.
And there's a book called The Surgeon of Crowthorne, isn't
it? Absolutely, yeah. And that's the same Crowthorne. Mm, mm. But the Road Research Laboratory is there. And I went along with lots of other people to look at, walk on textured surfaces.
Mm.
And fortunately, we all decided on the one that was the best one to use, and that was it. 9 months later, I get a telephone call, I was at Nottingham, saying, we've fitted up the first crossing, and we've done it outside the Palace of Westminster, which is just round the corner from Big Ben. You know, Big Ben is the actual bell within the Elizabeth Tower.
Right.
And I said, well, I'm in London next week, I'll go and have a look at it. And, you know, for some extraordinary reason, they'd put this textured surface all across the footpath, the whole width of the crossing. And there were dolly birds in high heel shoes wobbling across it, and there were
dolly birds.
And that's right. And there were mums with prams bouncing their kids across it. And it's absolutely hopeless.
Mm.
I got back to Nottingham. I picked up the phone to Department of Transport, my contact there. I'm not sure. Anyway, I suspect he's a very senior guy, and I don't suppose he has too many phone calls like this. And I just told him, you've blown it. You've absolutely blown it. This is totally unacceptable. You don't need it across the whole of the width of the crossing. All you need is a strip across the curb and a strip, maybe a single strip, back across the pavement.
Mm.
And why not have this strip so it leads the person to where he needs to be? So if it's a zebra crossing, which they have in England, lead him to the middle. So it's a T-shaped arrangement. If, on the other hand, it's a pole with a push button on it, lead him to the pole. So it would be an L-shaped.
Mm.
And he said, oh, well, draw it out on a piece of paper and fax it to me. The old days of faxes.
Yeah.
And that took all of about 5 minutes, and I faxed it off to him. Now, normally when the department gets some sort of new idea like that, it's evaluated for months and months and months. Not this. That following week, that crossing was dug up and it became a T-shaped textured surface. And there are T's and L's all over England now. And in fact, they're in Australia as well. It's everywhere.
More recently in Australia, I think, they're kind of a white panel that you have. And I actually looked at them and wondered why they're like that. And now, because you've explained that textured surface, it's alerting someone who's perhaps using a cane or they're only partially sighted.
Yes.
And it's giving them something which they can feel with their feet or a cane, and it's telling them there's a threshold here. If you pause here, this is the place to wait while the traffic's cleared or the sound changes on the crossing. And I think you're going to come to this maybe, but there's a sound also that goes.
Oh, yes. Well, that's the next story.
Right, right.
yes, and of course, the textured surface is often a different colour because most blind people can see a bit, you know. And I'm legally blind now, but I can see a bit, you know.
Well, you're reading from a page in front of you.
Well, I'm not reading at the moment. I'm doing it.
Okay.
but I can read in really good light, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the next thing happened with the department was that, yes, we have these pedestrian crossings. You press the button and join the green man phase. You have what's called the Ericsson rattle ticker. It goes tick, 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 tick. In England, they have a bleeper. Beep, 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 and you can cross the road. The problem is that if you have several of these at a crossing, and an example would be Kew Junction in Camberwell.
Mm.
If you press the button there and listen, there's a cacophony of beeps going on all over the place.
It's a five-way intersection for people who don't
Right.
know.
Yeah. And you've got to decide which is yours.
Mm.
So in England, they wouldn't have that. They would not have them at crossings.
Mm.
Neither would they have them at what we call dual carriageways. You call them divided roads, where you have a crossing, a sheep pen, and then another crossing.
Mm.
And again, you might press the button and hear a bleep, and it be the other one, not yours. So they wouldn't have them there as well.
Yeah, right.
So the blind people were stuck. They couldn't cross. And I had an idea. I asked them if I could borrow one of their push-button boxes. You see, they send it to me in the post. And I borrowed a Lego motor from my young sons, and I got a toothpaste tube cap, a knurled cap, and I built in this Lego motor into the bottom of this push-button box and wired it up so that it pretended to be a level crossing. And you press the button, and during the Green Man phase, this knurled knob wound round, and it was driven through a clutch. So if you were to grasp it hard, it wouldn't wind you up like Tom and Jerry. It would just slip. And I showed it to the Department of Transport, and they said, "Wow, that's super, but we need it made out of stainless steel. Can you find someone to make it?" So I got the Yellow Pages out, and I found a firm on the outskirts of Nottingham called Rustington Engineering. I mean, you couldn't make it up, could you? Can you imagine an engineering firm with the word rust in it anyway? I went along there, and the guy thought, this is fantastic. He'd love to get involved with, you know, the university and the Department of Transport. And he made about six prototypes, and they were evaluated by the Department of Transport, and they decided they'd put them in all over the country. And in fact, they paid Nottingham University a royalty for everyone that went in, and Nottingham University shared that royalty with me and with the people at Rustington Engineering. So that was a sort of
a bit of a bonus. That royalty is still being received.
No, not now, no. But it went on for 25 years, that's so cool. It went on for a long time. Yep. And they put them in all the sort of silent crossings, yep. And then for some extraordinary reason, they put them in the other crossings as well.
So the vibrating thing you did with the motor out of the Lego, and then that obviously got done properly by Rustington Engineering.
Yes, it's now a stainless steel knob that rotates.
So the idea is that it's giving you a vibration that you can feel? Is that what it is?
Yes, I mean, most people don't even know it's there, but you press the button. Imagine a totally blind person.
Yeah.
He can press the button, and then he slips his hand underneath the box.
Yeah.
He finds this knob, grasps it, and when the time comes for the Green Man phase for him to set off, it starts to rotate.
And so it gets around that confusion of noise that you might have on a multi-road.
That's like right. They don't. That's right. Yeah. And where the crossings are silent,
of course,
it's the only thing he's got.
Yeah. And also, I mean, these days with a lot of traffic noise, it can be very hard to hear that beep, beep, beep
anyway.
Well,
that's right. And then there was something else absolutely extraordinary. 1981 was the International Year of Disability. And I got a telephone call from the Department of Transport and said, "Think of an idea. We need something that involves technology, disability, and science, you know, something along those lines." And I said, "Hang on a minute. You've got this road research laboratory at Crowther and all these people there. Why me? Oh, you're full of ideas. You'll think of something." Well, 10 years before, I'd worked in San Francisco for a while, and I had an incredible experience. I was driven across the Golden Gate Bridge in the passenger seat of an E-Type Jaguar.
With the roof off.
Oh, the roof off. It was absolutely a glorious way to cross that bridge for the first time. Mm. And I said to the driver, "Look, hang on, all these other people are stopping at the toll booth and paying. You haven't paid." He said, "No, look at that gantry." And I looked at a gantry ahead, and it said something like $26.50 on it. And he said, "That's my bank balance. That's my credit." And I said, "How did it do that?" He said, "Well, I've got a transponder in the car. There's a loop in the road, and as I go over the loop, it reads my car, it interrogates my bank balance, and puts up the number." Now, these days, it's like an e-tag, of course, yeah, but yeah. In those days, this was, I was blown away by this. I thought it was fantastic. So, anyway, these guys at the Department of Transport said, "Come up and have lunch with us in 10 days' time and tell us what you thought, obviously." Well, in 10 days' time, I went up to Bristol, because that's where the traffic engineering group is, and I was met at the station by about three people I knew and about four or five people I didn't know. And they took me to lunch, sat me at the head of the table and said, "Well, Dr. Hayes, what have you come up with?" And I said, "How about a talking bus stop?" Well, even with my poor eyesight, I could see the body language, you know, heads in hands. "Oh, dear, what's this guy on about?" And I decided I'd have to camp this up a bit. So I slid my chair back and said, "No, when I get home tonight, get off the train, I go to get my bus, I could do one of two things. I can lean into the road with my hand out to slow it down until I'm certain it's not mine and then wave him on. Or I can wait peering into the gloom at the number until I can read it and I am certain it's mine and leap out and stop him. Neither technique goes down well with the bus driver because I don't see very well and it doesn't give him much time. Mm-hmm. What we could do is have a loop buried in the road 100 yards upstream. We could have a transponder on the bus and a speech synthesizer in the bus stop, and the bus stop could say ding dong and a six approaching. Well, at this point, the body language had stopped. They thought this old fool's got something, got a good idea here. I said, well, if you're going to do that, you could put a push button on the bus stop, and you could press the button, and it could say, the buses that use this bus stop are the number 6, next one due in 10 minutes, and the number 54, next one due in 20 minutes. Well, this was the idea. They took it back to base.
What happens if the bus doesn't run on time?
Ah, well, then there are problems, of course. But anyway, they took this idea back to the minister. What I didn't know was that Sir Humphrey, remember, yes, minister, the Sir Humphrey character at the Department of Transport at this time was Sir Peter Baldwin. Now, he had worked at Bletchley Park during the war on code breaking and things like that. So he was very much into technology. He thought this was a fantastic idea. And the minister at the time was a lady, Linda Chalker. She's now Baroness Chalker. She's a very able politician. And they said, we'll go for it. And they set it up on a trial basis at a little seaside town called Weston-super-Mare, just outside Bristol. The reason they chose that, it was near Bristol, but Weston-super-Mare has a number of hotels that specialise in holidays for blind people. And so we had a bit of a celebration, a launch. We had it fitted on several bus stops. We had blind people along, we had the press along, Department of Transport people along, the minister came along. And I lived in Nottingham with four little children. My girls were 10 and 8 and my boys were 6 and 4. Well, they very rarely got to the seaside, and if Daddy's going to Weston-super-Mare, why didn't I take the kids along, you see? So I took my family along, which horrified some members of the Department of Transport. But the minister thought that was great. She cut the cake and she organised my daughters to take the pieces of cake round to the blind people. And the whole thing was a celebration. It was great and it worked very well. The problem was, though, that it was a Tory government and they were privatising the bus companies, selling them off. And the new owners didn't really want to spend money on this sort of thing. But talking signs and displays like this are now everywhere. We're talking about 1981. Mm. Now, it's these things, and I've since found that it is these things that have caused Richard Alsop, who I didn't know, he may have been part of that group in Bristol. I don't remember him, which is very sad. Mm. But he's left my kids £10,000. How nice.
Fantastic.
And it wasn't a scam.
And were you slightly put out that he didn't just leave it to you?
No, not at all. My kids said, you should have it, Dad. So I said, no, you have it and buy me a pint.
Well, isn't that what a great story. And are you going to find out any more about this, the benefactor? Are you going to find out a bit more?
Oh, I will. I've been reading about
it. I mean, I know that you've checked with lawyers and made sure that his will is legit and all the rest of it.
Well, I will send the link to this recorded conversation Ben Heydecker and to the lawyers and hopefully to the widow of the guy who died, and I will find out more about it. I'd never rated this thing. I mean, it worked and it was okay, but it wasn't rocket science. I was very proud of my parking sensor. That's a bit of technology which is really
absolutely
quite clever.
Absolutely.
And that's what I did, and it was a spin-off by Aid for the Blind. This was stuff I did on the side. This was something that I never talked about before because I'd never taken it very seriously. I was just the grit in the oyster that came up with, stimulated a few things.
Now, just for the listeners to fill them in on the background to the parking sensors. So, and this is covered in a separate podcast, which you can find on beyondinfinity.com.au, or you can go to Tony's website, Sonic Pathfinder. from memory.
Yes, sonicpathfinder.org.
.org. And you'll also find copies of that recording or links to that recording anyway. But you invented effectively what became a parking sensor, which most cars have nowadays, those little round circles on the bumpers of cars, front and back usually. And you went along to Jaguar, just to summarise it quickly for listeners, you went along to Jaguar in Coventry and they basically said, oh, the only reason why you want to do that is because you're blind and the average person wouldn't use it. So it was kind of rejected out of hand.
Not quite. I was driving. I had one eye and they said, look, they drove my car up and down with a prototype and they said, look, it's very nice, Dr. Hayes, but we have to tell you, you like it because you're a partially sighted. With one eye, you can't judge your distances. Real people wouldn't want a thing like this.
So you'd invented it, but it wound up in common use, but you hadn't patented it.
I patented it in 1983.
Right.
And here again, a funny story. My patent agent was called Swindle and Pearson. you couldn't make it up. The people at university used to call them Swindle, Grab It and Run. Anyway,
did they live up to their name or did they do the right thing?
No, they did the right thing. We took out a patent, but nobody was interested in putting this on their car.
Oh,
nobody
so wanted... it had lapsed by the time it did?
It lapsed by about the year 2000 when this thing... They only last 15 years, and by the year 2000 when this thing began to appear on original equipment, then the patent had expired. But I did put it on trucks and delivery vans and things. I got involved with a local firm in Nottingham and we did put quite a number of...
Okay. So you did get some royalty. You did make something out of that.
I didn't... Well, I didn't lose on it. Okay. No, I didn't lose on it. But I you know, if Anna, I'd had a couple of dollars for everyone...
I know. It would be great. I know.
I don't think we'd be sitting here.
I was talking to my daughter about that and she was going, my God, so he must be a... You know,
a multi-millionaire, absolutely. Yeah, no, not quite.
Well, what a great story. And I guess what would also be interesting to know, if you do any sort of follow-up with your benefactor or with your kid's benefactor, it would be to find out who else he left money to.
Apparently so. I did speak to the lawyers and they said, look, it's a very complicated will because there are about 50 benefactors already and you've just added four more.
So he did it by name. So he's named 50 people who he believed contributed to transport development or transport efficiency, safety in the UK.
And Professor Ben... Heidecker had the job of actually making sure they identified the right people. Mm-hmm. So he was actually looking into my background at the same time that I was querying what all this was about.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you very much, Tony. That's great. And I think it's also great that your work was acknowledged. And I think it must be something that you would feel rather chuffed about to have this very sort of late in the day out of the blue recognition.
Well, two things make me chuff. One is, I whenever I go to England, I can't walk through a town without seeing things that wouldn't be like it was had it not been for me, which is, you know, a bit of fun.
Yeah.
And some years ago, I took my grandchildren to... I have grandchildren in England. Took them to the Transport Museum in London. And there were things in that museum that I'd invented. And now that makes me feel very old.
Yeah, well, it's great. And, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. So you had a sort of... You had a technical background, but you also had a need.
Absolutely, and I think it was my need, my living with low vision has caused me to have ideas that would help me and other people with low vision and the general population.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great story and there's some really good ones if you want to listen and find out more about Dr. Tony Hayes, who I'm talking to now. There's another one called The Life of a Scientist, which is a kind of summary of your career, which is very interesting, including being at university with Stephen Hawking, the late great astrophysicist. So, yeah, I'd urge you to check them out. You can just do a search for Tony Hayes at beyondinfinity.com.au or you can go to sonicpathfinder.org for more on this.
If people are searching for me, they have to realise that I come from a family of bad spellers. We spell Hayes, H-E-Y-E-S.
Yes, you get that right. Okay. All right, well, thank you very much, Tony. That's a great story. Let's hope that the other 49 recipients are as worthy as you are.
It'd be interesting to find out all about them.